Okay, welcome everyone to the spring semester. We always call it a semester. We're not a university, we always call it a semester, I guess, don't we, David? So we end up doing.
Feels like a semester.
It feels like a semester. Welcome to Dallas Philosopher Swarm. Great to have everybody here today. We were afraid it would be a low turnout because of the State of the Union speech tonight. But anyway, Dallas Philosopher Swarm, a non-for-profit organization. Our goal is to bring philosophy, ideas, critical thinking to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson, and I want to mention that we meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And everyone should have our new schedule. If not, then just let me know and we'll get it to you. It's also on our website, www.philosophersforum.org. So if you haven't paid already, you came in a little bit early. Our treasurer, David Drum, make sure you pay him before you leave. It's $5. Or if you're a student, it's $2. And we normally don't even check you. It's an honor system. We don't even check your ID. If you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. And then I want to remind everyone to pay for your meals and drinks and be generous with your wait staff. And the manager asked me to just mention that there's some people that just come and drink the water and eat the chips and salsa. And he asked that if you do that, that's okay, but please order a tea or a drink. We would appreciate that. And if you don't want to do that, then just eat plenty before you come, and then you don't, can avoid that situation. But we are a non-for-profit organization. We are all volunteers. And we all love what we do and want to bring the best philosophy that we possibly can to the DFW area. So we have, I just want to talk about our schedule. Oh, Jack, do you have one schedule for me? So the board members and I have been busy lining up speakers. We have Dr. Carter speaking on the politics of anger. We have presentations on depletion marketing, the ethics of that, the meaning of objectivity. A lot of variety. We have a topic on Africa, on sexual autonomy, immigration, the biological, sociologic, and historical basis of beauty. Dr. Alkek, raise your hand, Dr. Alkek, he'll be speaking on that in April. Plagiarism. And this reminds me that one time an attendee said, you know, what about the pure philosophy? It seems like y'all are deviating from pure philosophy. He said it in a real nice way. But I recall thinking and reading about this, and I found the quote that I was looking for. You know, I think you said, why don't you have more epistemology and ethics and pure philosophy? And I read a quote at American Philosophers Association, and I want to read it to you real quick. Philosophy is quite unlike any other field. It is unique both in its methods and in the nature and breadth of its subject matter. Philosophy pursues questions in every dimension of human life, and its techniques apply to problems in any field of study or endeavor. No brief definition expresses the richness and variety of philosophy. Consider, for instance, human knowledge. What is its nature and extent? Must we always have evidence in order to know? What kind of knowledge, if any, is fundamental? Similar kinds of questions arise concerning art, morality, religion, science, and each of the major areas of human endeavor. Philosophy explores all of them. It views them both microscopically and from the wide perspective of the larger concerns of human existence. And so I thought that was that's sort of my philosophy. I don't know if the board agrees with that or not, but that's sort of my philosophy on that topic. I also want to mention that we're thinking in the fall of having an open forum where you would make suggestions on topics you would like us to talk about. We might have about five or six of those and spend about 15 minutes in an open discussion, maybe have a discussion leader on each of these different topics. Maybe you feel like, I think you had mentioned, young lady, you had mentioned a topic that you wanted us to consider. What topic was that?
I don't think I really want to talk about it right now.
Too complex? Oh, nothing's too complex for us. Okay, so give us a thought, mention it to one of the board members. Ken, or Jack, or David, one of us, and we can take that into consideration as well. And also, we have a lot of the same information on our website, and any first-time visitors. Okay, how'd you hear about us?
Online, Facebook.
Okay, Facebook? Okay, great. Anybody else? Yes, how'd you hear about us? Okay, great. Very good.
You've got two over here.
Oh, yes.
All right, I'm online as well.
Okay. Okay, very good. Yeah, have you invited us? Meet up or?
The meet them, sorry.
Okay. Okay, very good. Well, welcome to everyone. So our speaker will lecture for about 45 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. And so make sure you make a fairly short statement and then get your question as soon as you can. And then one last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have Dr. Bradley Carter from SMU with us tonight. Dr. Carter was one of my favorite professors, undergraduate school and graduate school, and you're in for a real treat tonight. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 1972, and your master's as well, right, from Berkeley?
No,
University of Miami, that's right. Illinois for the bachelor's and University of Miami for your master's. Oh, I got a slip. Okay. He's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and has been at SMU since 1970 and recently retired, but you're still teaching a class, as I'm teaching a theory class. Dr. Carter's teaching and research interests include political thought, organizational theory, American and British politics, and institutional development. He's written on James Madison and Mary Parker Follett. Dr. Carter served as president of the Faculty Senate and was chief marshal of the university for 19 years. He has received both the Emerald Award and the Willis M. Tate Award and was twice selected as a Rotunda Outstanding Professor. Dr. Carter will be speaking tonight about the politics of anger. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Brad Carter.
I want to thank Mr. Olson for inviting me tonight. And I am very, very pleased and honored to be here. Try to remember which is
it. Push it on the right to advance and left to reverse. Aim at the computer.
Aim it at the computer. Ah.
Push the button on the right. Push it here.
Oh, okay. Philosophers are not always good engineers. John Courtney Murray, a Jesuit theorist, said of the polity, the state, it lacks the cordial warmth of love and unreasoning loyalty that pervades the family. It is cool and dry, with the coolness and dryness that characterize good argument among informed and responsible men. He adds, the distinctive bond of the civil multitude is reason. Murray knew that that was a very, very high standard, a very high normative standard, not always lived up to, indeed, not always even attempted. But he believed it to be a standard of the greatest importance. This standard seems quaint today, doesn't it? Seems very quaint today. So quaint that talking about politics among a group of philosophers committed to reason and to clear linear arguments seems all but inappropriate. But times such as this and our present politics of anger are a recurring phenomenon. Our times calling for, and I think demanding, philosophical engagement. We may not be able to restore coolness or reason in our political life. But rational analysis may help us, at the very least, puzzle our way to an understanding of why anger and why irrationality play so large a role in the United States and in Western Europe. Sometimes just moving toward understanding is a philosophical victory. But I trust that we can do better than that. A word about the title. I hesitated between disappointment and anger. But disappointment can be a very passive sort of thing. It's a sort of thing that simply encourages disengagement. As civic life in the Roman Empire, people began to disengage. They were disappointed, but they weren't particularly angry. Anger is a very positive thing in some ways because it often leads to action. Not always the best of action, but action nonetheless. It does not lead to disengagement. And I suspect politics could more easily absorb anger than it could absorb disengagement, especially the politics of a republic, which, as our founders reminded us, cannot stand, cannot tolerate, cannot endure if there is this engagement. There are two caveats I'm going to offer up tonight. First, my prism is that of political theory, not of political philosophy. My prism is that of political theory. Political theory is an applied philosophy. Political theory is to philosophy what engineering is to physics. We try to see, to explain, to alter. It is normative, but it is normative based on descriptive work, on empirical work. And it always asks the three questions: what is desirable, and what is possible? I'm not sure that pure philosophy does that. It doesn't have to get down in the trenches along with ethics to figure out what is possible. But theory and ethics are bound to real life and real people. Not that philosophy isn't. I was intrigued by what Rob said a few moments ago when he talked about justifying that which is not altogether traditionally philosophic. Because a few years ago, SMU created a series of pillars. This is becoming rampant around the United States. And all of its undergraduate courses were meant to fit in a certain pillar. And political theory courses, for the most part, fit in two pillars: institutions and also philosophical, religious, and ethical thought. Five. All of my courses but one were approved for both of those pillars, but not my 20th century course, because I had the temerity to teach both Krugman and Friedman. And the philosophers on the committee thought that Friedman and Krugman were just not appropriate. And I said, but you know, David Friedman was one of the most articulate and one of the most important spokespersons for Hayek's theory of free enterprise. And Krugman is, after all, the New York Times, you may not agree with him, but he's an important writer. Maybe not as important as Friedman, but in that category. And they basically said, nonsense, those people are mere popular writers. And in a way, I understood that. I did understand that. But I also balked at it, because I think wherever ideas come from, if they're germane to public discourse, they can be very important. And the source is not as important as the consequences, in my opinion. A philosophical system is a simple thing in many ways, as far as this diagram is concerned. It's simply a set of answers to important political questions. Why obey? What is the purpose of government? Are humans rational? Are humans good? What should society be all about? And those answers, of course, have to be consistent. If you found a theory that said people were no damn good, but that elevated democracy to a high goal, you would think of that as not really fitting together, would you not? If people are no good, no democracy could follow. If people were altogether as good as angels, then, of course, you would probably advocate anarchism, because you would not need government. And, you know, James Madison, one of our great founders, said, basically, we're a little lower than the angels. Humans are not angels, but we're not devils either. And for the most part, we're fairly rational and fairly virtuous. And that is the understanding that our founders built on. A consistent ideology. Basically, they borrowed from John Locke, right? We call it liberalism now, not the American sense of the word liberal, but the European, believing in a free economy, a free government, a free religious experience. So, from this philosophical system, you can easily see why the utopia is written out. You diagnose what is wrong with contemporary society. You come up with a prescription how to alter those changes, and you build from that a new possible world, a utopia, we might call it, an altered universe, a new society, a new political order. That's understandable. But you know, if you stop and think about it, and again, we're getting to the reality of things. When people go to do the descriptive work, the scientific work, they also do not have a lobotomy. They are driven by their philosophical ideas. There are very few people who study politics that don't like politics. There are very few people who study the cinema who don't like the cinema. There are very few musicologists who cannot stand music. And so there's already a bias, isn't there? Hey, I think politics is interesting. I want to study this issue. Or hey, I'm an economist or a sociologist or a political scientist, and I am fascinated by poverty. And that usually means you think poverty is something that can be taken care of, and you probably think it's terrible. It's something that ought to be exorcised from society, ought to be removed from society. And so our descriptive work, which is very important, our descriptive work also has a basis in our philosophical system. And as a matter of fact, I would suggest it's almost equal to what it has on the normative side of that equation, of that diagram. In a very real sense, in a very real sense, understanding of the existing world is very, very difficult. And while we have to be on guard against our own prejudices and likes and dislikes, we would have no study without some of those likes and those dislikes. So again, to study what is desirable, and what is possible. And that last question is where we get in trouble. Because some people believe you can't go beyond that. Whatever is now is what is possible. It can never be changed. It can never be changed. I remember a few years ago, at the end of an honors convocation at SMU, a woman came up to me. Her daughter had just won 3 awards in the engineering school. And she said, I graduated from our School of Engineering 28 years ago. And she said, when I first came to the School of Engineering that first year, I would go into classes and professors would say, we have 3 women in this class. That is 3 redundant bodies. We all know that women cannot understand engineering. After all, Aristotle said early on, that women could not really be rational thinkers because women could not do geometry. And I often say to my male students, wouldn't you hate your masculinity to be determined by your high school geometry grades? And I imagine there are some gentlemen in the room tonight who would not wish their masculinity to be based on their high school grades. A second caveat. I'm not going to see, I hope we're not going to see, anger as evil per se. Because as I say, anger can lead to change and reform. But we will examine how it can often blind us to false causalities. You who are philosophically inclined have to think a lot about causality, do you not? And that is one of the hardest things in the world to really ponder, isn't it? Does A cause B? What are the intervening variables? How can we prove this causality? And very often, you know, we get ourselves, or the German people, for example, in the 1930s, got themselves into this false reality of saying all the problems of the world are caused by the Jew. And people in Boston about this earlier in the 19th century said all the problems of Boston are caused by these new Irish Catholics. You find a false causality and you stick to it. And then you don't explore all of the other possible alternatives. In the cases that we're about to examine tonight, frustration, fear, and disappointment create anger and give shape to a political culture of anger. And I've noticed that talking to some of you, you understand as I do that we have a pretty angry society, both in this country and in Western Europe. I don't dare to speak of other areas of the world because Western political and Western political activity is relatively different than some of those other areas of the world. But you know, we've had other periods like this, many. I would mention the Reformation, which if you look at it historically, built up over a rather long period of time. The Industrial Revolution, the same thing. the Great Depression of 1929, there are these moments, these periods, where there is so much unrest, and where people are at each other's throats, and where people are just mad. These are periods in which old scripts, old theories, no longer seem to help. And often there's a realization of loss of control. You know, the Great Depression or the Industrial Revolution left people bewildered. I don't know if any of you last year watched Cold Dark on Channel 13, but you saw the Industrial Revolution come to Cornwall and they weren't ready for it. The trouble was, nobody was ready for it. We look back, don't we, and we can say, oh, the Industrial Revolution, and we can give elegant lectures, economic lectures, or sociological lectures, and talk about the rise of a new working class. They didn't have that script, did they? They were experiencing something de novo, and it shocked them, and it surprised them. All scripts won't work anymore. This also relates to another problem that I want to mention, a tendency to let our wishes become reality. For example, the Palestinians, and I have great admiration for Palestine, but they got themselves in trouble by assuming that the Israeli army was cowardly and effeminate, which was not the case, and they were punished sometimes for making that assumption. Or what our American collectivity did in 1945 to 1950, the loss of China. Somehow, we decided that somebody, some American probably, had lost China for us. Because we had the notion that China was a nation state and that it had a reasonable government. It had a functioning government. It was not a good government. It was not a functioning government. And China was not at that time truly a nation state. But we assumed that if China was lost, that is, if the communists won in China, somebody had, in a traitorous way, to have given China away. That's what I mean by false causality. You can make all sorts of criticisms of the Western world, of the Chinese themselves for that loss of China, but probably you cannot find that a treasonous act was involved. And there's yet another thing I want you to have in the back of your mind all evening. One of the great American political writers, Nelson Cosby, great political writer, reminds us that it's so easy to imagine that the people at the top of society are in complete control. The President of the United States, the President of Volkswagen, the President of General Motors, oh yes, all that power. Except if you're in the Oval Office, or in the presidential suite of one of those large corporations, you say, my God, these people are doing all sorts of things and they're not telling me, right? There are all sorts of things going on in this organization that I keep ordering them not to do. John Kennedy discovered that when during the Bay of Pigs, he said, but Mr. Khrushchev, we have taken away the missiles in Turkey. And then he said to the military, that's right, isn't it? And I said, well, no, Mr. President. You know, there was Christmas. And then all of a sudden it was Easter, and then it was vacation time. Mr. President, those missiles are still there. And Kennedy said things that are not fit for a philosophical gathering, or even with ladies in the room. He was not happy with that report. But we know full well that people at the top are not in absolute control. It's only when you're down at the very bottom of society, Cosby went on, that it looks like there is this gigantic pyramid that really works, because you know you have no control, and you just assume somebody has control. So we are living in a world with tension, anger, and uncertainty. It seems almost like there are tectonic plates that are grinding against each other. And I think we all fear an earthquake. I know that is very easy to do. And I know only because I've studied this for a very long time, I don't worry about it as much as, say, my sister, who tells me I'm a fool, because she has convinced herself that the world is very much, very much going to hell. But it's always been going to hell in one way or another. I've always really loved that passage in the Christian Bible where they ask Jesus, how do you know that the end of times has come? And he says, there will be wars and rumors of war. And when have there not been? When have there not been? You know, the problem is, when you are living something, it's very hard to follow, isn't it? Hegel, who's one of the great thinkers of the Western world, Hegel talked about the owl of Minerva, spreading her wings only in the encircling twilight. She goes out and she takes a very long series of reconnaissance flights. She goes out and she's gone for a long time. And even when she comes back, understanding comes slowly. It's so much easier to read about something 100 years after the fact. The owl of Minerva is spreading her wings. She's circling around our world. She's seeing in this inaugural flight a whole Western world that is angry. In the United States, there's the Tea Party. There's the Trump candidacy. There's the Warren Sanders movement. But we are going to get the United States after we look at Europe. Because Europe, in many ways, is angrier than we are. Can you believe it? They're much more upset than we are. A friend of mine just came back from having moved to France. He and his wife had lived in Dallas for a very long time, and she was French. And he came back as an American. He said, you people are so lucky. He said, you know, Europe is just very, very upset, especially with the economy. And everybody thinks of you as having the best economy in the world. And I said, and many of his other friends said, well, we don't think that way anymore, right? Americans are very convinced that they're poor, that their country is poor, that things are going very badly. In a very real sense, Europe is more depressed than we, and perhaps, therefore, more depressed than we, and more angry than we. I want to begin with the United Kingdom, because most of us, I think, probably know a little more about the United Kingdom than we do about some other places in the world. And there's a man by the name of Lafarge, not a very English name, but he is the head of the United Kingdom Independence Party. The United Kingdom Independence Party is winning over the working class, from the labor perspective, at an alarming rate. White male voters, because they've been left behind by Britain's rapid economic and social transformation and left out of political conversation. Struggling people who feel like strangers in a society where the ruling elite doesn't even know they exist. And this should ring very well alarm bells to the left. After all, even though UKIP only won one seat in the last parliamentary election, they gained over 25%, gained over 15% of the votes. 15% doesn't sound like a great deal, but they came in on public opinion polls much higher than that. At the last moment, a lot of people said, okay, I will give Labour, I will give the Tories one more chance. But in the back of their mind, there was this UKIP attraction. And this is a party that we would consider to be very chauvinistic and very populist. It should, but it didn't necessarily in that election bring all sorts of alarm bells for Labour. Because here you have a time of falling income, rising inequality, spending cuts, health cuts, all sorts of problems with protection and redistribution. But instead of switching their votes to the Labour Party, because they had many of them moved away from the Labour Party to vote Tory the time before, they went after a candidate, a party, that was very, very much right-wing, headed by a stockbroker and staffed by activists who loved Margaret Thatcher and thought that the Conservatives had pulled away from her sterling leadership. So in many ways, the people who were hit hardest by the crisis, hit hardest by austerity, were turning not to Labour, but to UKIP. In that same election, too, something happened north of the English border, didn't it? Did you follow that? I'm a political scientist. We do strange and weird things. You philosophers do, we do too. I stay up and watch British election returns. I've done that for years. This year, I was saved by a power shortage in Carrollton from having the whole night spent looking at that. But if you watch that election, you know that every party north of the English border was wiped out. in the representations at Westminster. Labour got one vote. Labour had been the party in Scotland. The Conservatives got one seat. And so too the Liberal Democrats. All of the rest were Scottish nationalists, including a young woman who had taken over a seat from one of the most important of the shadow Labour ministers. You know, in England, there's always a shadow minister for every minister. The opposition is always ready to take over. And so you find yourself in a very strange situation, with England now having, with Scotland having no Labour rights. And that means that in all probability, since that was the core of the British Labour Party, it may well be that it will be decades before, again, there is a Labour victory in the United Kingdom. If there is a United Kingdom, we don't know what the Scottish Nationalists will do. And by the way, this isn't a criticism of Scottish Nationalists. I understand them. They're very interesting people, and their ideas may not be bad. I have to tell myself every once in a while, and some of you have to tell yourselves, I had great-grandfathers that fought for a dissolution of the American Union, right? Some of you did too. And so that is, and in Spain, the Catalonians are fighting for that. That's always an alternative. Whether it's a rational alternative or not, that is something for discussion. But I loved what an author said in a recent book called Revolt on the Right. He said of UKIP, not so much SNP, but he had some jabs at the SNP for the same reason. He said, don't think of UKIP as a party. Think of them as a symptom of a far deeper social and values dimension. Think of them as a symptom of an illness. Because these people who are voting that way have felt very, very betrayed. They have felt so impotent, so politically cast adrift, that one can almost understand why they are angry. It's easy to understand. And then there's that interesting thing that happened in the Labour Party. As you may or may not know, the British socialists grew to loathe Tony Blair. And one of the things I think they enjoyed doing this time around was to do one last slap in the face of Tony Blair. They hated the war that Tony Blair had gotten them into. They called him Bush's lap poodle, and they despised him. And so they have a chance, for the first time, to actually vote for their leader. Always before, the Labour members of the House of Commons chose the leader. And now it was up to the whole party. Not just the leadership of the party, the whole party. And most of the candidates were standard Tony Blair-like politicians. And they weren't exciting to the voters, and they were defeated rather overwhelmingly. And this man, who had always been at the very fringe of the Labour Party, was elected the leader of the Labour Party. And when people in the Labour Party were asked, well, do you think he can win in 2020? They said, we don't care. He is a man who is absolutely committed to principle. He is a man who is not Tony Blair. And never again will we do what we did in the past, go for a man just because he can win elections. We don't care whether Mr. Corbyn wins elections. And of course, any number of Labourites who say, that's silly, that's wrong, and maybe they will convince people ultimately to get rid of Mr. Corbyn, but he is in office right now. One writer writes this. Says, and this writer is anti-Corbyn, the state responds to a crisis in capitalism by rewarding the capitalists. That sounds kind of like America, left and right, right? Piling the blame on everyone who is not to blame, the young, the poor, the homeless, and the low paid. Perhaps readers of this article work in the public sector and have seen the services they provide belittled and shrunk, and their wages held down indefinitely. Maybe they include young readers who can only see a future of debt and insecurity. That is, again, the rational basis of the problem. You may be skeptical of that anger, but there are some very, very real problems behind that anger. Turning to France and Germany for just a moment. France and Germany have not had a bad patch, as bad patches go for France and Germany. You know, that wonderful thing, that wonderful victory of rationality in 1945 to 1948, the creating of the Marshall Plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And General de Gaulle's brilliant observation, brilliant prophecy, he said, we're going to just put our arms around the Germans, and we are going to hug them so closely, they will never be able to put a dagger in our back again. And it worked, didn't it? Europe created a federation, and France and Germany have become, I won't say friends, but they have become good allies, have they not? And even when they are irritated with each other, Mr. Merkel and President Hollande, Mrs. Merkel and President Hollande smile at each other and act as if they are the best of friends, do they not? But Germany has its Alliance for Progress and Renewal, and France has its National Front, headed by Madame Le Pen. Both of these groups oppose the EU. They tend to be anti-elitist, anti-Islamic, and anti-immigrant. And that is a fascinating thing in and of itself. You know, and again, there are some rational reasons. We saw what happened in Cologne this weekend, right? There are some problems associated with taking a very large number of people into the country. But the political group that is most opposed to that is not even one of these right-wing parties. It's the version of the Christian Democrats that contest in Bavaria. It's a Catholic party in Bavaria. The Christian Democrats are Catholic and Protestant, but in Bavaria, they are altogether Catholic, because Bavaria is altogether Catholic. And what has happened? Bavaria, Catholic Bavaria, has forgotten all about the Sermon on the Mount, has forgotten all about how you're supposed to, as a good Christian, reach out to others, and has really neglected the teachings of the Pope on the issue. The party says the Pope, after all, doesn't live in Germany, which is a strange thing for the leader of a Catholic party to say in Bavaria, but he got away with it. And I guess if you get away with something, it is all right. It becomes acceptable. But anyway, you have some real problems in those countries. But we will move on, and we will look now at Spain and Greece, two of the basket cases of Europe, right? The South in Europe is not doing very well at all. Different dynamics exist in Spain and Greece, but the same story is there. A fight against northern domination, northern Europe, i.e. Germany, and austerity. In Spain, it is Podemos, a brand new party, headed by a man named Iglesias. Spain has only recently found itself with having a third party. They didn't have one for a very long time. Podemos wasn't even founded until 2014, and now it's the third largest party in the country. And it's broken the old two-party, left-right party conflicts that had marked Spain for a very long time. And two parties were a very useful device, right? Because you're assured of responsible and majority government. They won't have that for a while. But the socialists in Spain and the Popular Party in Spain had not handled the financial crisis very, very well at all. So there is Podemos in Spain, and there is in Greece, Syriza, which is again a very new party that is doing very, very well. It is doing so well that even though it's new, their leader is prime minister. These are both parties that are fighting austerity. And please understand, when Europeans talk about austerity, they are not talking about the kind of conditions that prevailed in World War II Britain. what they are really talking about is a diminution of funds. And so nobody sees the ability to have jobs, to pay off their debts. The young don't even have jobs. Greek unemployment is 24%. People between 15 and 24 who are on the job market, only about 30% have jobs. Spanish unemployment is 23%. These people are hurting. And Greece has seen a spike with all of its austerity demands, demands that the Germans put on them of HIV infection, suicides, and infant mortality. Life in Greece is not good. And so, again, they have decided that there is one person responsible for all of this, the woman that until recently was called, moving in Germany, Chancellor Merkel. She's not as popular now as she was a few weeks ago. Popularity is something that politicians never keep forever, right? But there is this great passion in Spain, and especially in Greece. And of course, there's a reason in Greece. There was unpleasantness in Greece from 41 to 45 that the Germans caused, and almost every Greek remembers that. And so every once in a while they will say to the Germans, after all, you messed up our country. And the Germans say, that was a long time ago. And the Greeks say, not that long ago. It was interesting, many years ago, when Germany reunited, they did a poll in Europe. Gallup did a poll in every European country. And there were only two countries in Europe that were not terribly concerned about German reunification. They were Spain and Portugal. And if you stop and think about it, the Pyrenees were there, and the Spanish and the Portuguese were not terribly worried. The day after Germany reunited, the Luxembourgers put a sign on the border that said, notice to the German army on its way to France. We will not resist. Please buy trinkets and cold drinks as you pass through our country. And the German foreign minister was not amused and protested to the Luxembourg foreign minister. And the Luxembourg foreign minister said, well, that's what you've done twice. And we assume this will happen again. And he said, no, we're all good Germans now. And the Luxembourg foreign minister said in elegant language, yeah, so you say. There is still that animosity. And there's another kind of animosity in two other of the European countries, in Poland and in Hungary. Poland and Hungary. If austerity divides Europe north and south, a package of issues also seems to divide in east and west. There's anger especially in Poland and Hungary over Middle Eastern refugees and social liberalism, and by social liberalism I mean the kind of liberalism that permeates the United States. Relaxed laws on divorce, etc., etc., etc. They call it gender issues, which ranges all the way from feminist liberation to the gay agenda, well, a variety of issues that are opposed by the church. And this unrest allows two very right-wing parties to form governments, first in Hungary and then in Poland. In Hungary, Viktor Orban, who has been involved with Hungarian politics for a very long time, champions what he calls illiberal democracy. And he actually praises Vladimir Putin. The Polish don't praise Vladimir Putin. They don't like him. But the Hungarians do. And the Polish prime minister has vowed to bring Budapest to Warsaw. These parties are almost Nazi-like. But you know, if you stop and think about it, look what happened to Hungary and Poland historically. Both of them had great problems with the brand new Soviet Union. A Soviet republic was established in Hungary right after they had thrown off the emperor king, and also in Poland, a war existed. A war broke out between Poland and the Russians. And so there is that. There is also, though, in both of those countries, a history of that trauma, that anti-Soviet trauma, putting a field marshal in charge of Poland and an admiral in charge of Hungary, Admiral Horthy, who was called by everyone the admiral without a navy, who was a king of a region of a country without a king. He was an Austro-Hungarian admiral. If you're wondering why Hungary had an admiral, it was the old Austro-Hungarian navy. Those two countries, and I just had some friends back from there, those two countries are increasingly acting in a very non-Western way. And indeed, the European Union is very, very concerned as they cut down and cut down and cut down on rights. In Hungary and in Poland, the public broadcasters have been taken over completely by the state. They always were autonomous, as the BBC is autonomous. They have been taken over by the state. So, recapping European anger. Anti-elite, also a great deal of nativism, a great deal of anti-Southern feeling and fear of Eastern Europeans in the West, and fear of the Westerners and their immorality in the East. But as the Economist said recently, part of this is all about pensions. We've already seen the Greek and Spanish argument against what has happened with pensions. But this article says, it's the pension, stupid. That, I am coming to conclude, is the cause of real sentiment being expressed toward Greece and places like Germany. It's not just that the German politicians and newspaper commentators are really cross about bailing out the profligate Greek government. It's because, for one thing, the Greeks are fussing because they've had to raise their retirement age from 61 to 63, and the Germans have just raised it from 63 to 67. So some of these complaints have a double dimension. Also, you know, part of the reason that money is such a problem for Europe is that they have a central bank without having a central government. The European Union is not a central government. It's a wonderful thing that in 1787 we created a central government. And in the early days of the last century, we created a central bank, right? But a central bank that has the backing of a government, and a central bank that has the ability to work with the government in providing our money source. You know, it's funny always the way central banks and governments coexist and fight with each other. One of the things that I read about years ago was up in Canada during the Depression. The central bank, the Bank of Canada, said it is a job of the government to make all economic and fiscal policy. And the government of Canada said it's a job of the central bank, the Bank of Canada, to make those policies. We created that kind of duality in part to limit government mistakes. And government is very often happy to have that because they don't get immediately blamed when unpopular decisions are made. The president of the Fed is not, after all, the chairman of the Fed, is not, after all, elected by the American people. What about the United States? I need to conclude rapidly. We've always had in this country a strong dose of anti-elitism. We've always disliked the elite. Now we call them the Brie and the Chablis set. We dislike the media elite. We dislike the military-industrial complex. We've always had a strong sense of nativism. Anti-Catholic movements in the 40s and the 50s. We've had in the 20s anti-Catholicism and anti-black movements. Anti-Semitism in the 1940s. We've had class conflict between small farmers and urban businessmen in the past, and now between smallholders and Wall Street in the present. And we have the Tea Party, and I have a long passage here that I'm not going to go into about the Tea Party, because I think you know about the Tea Party, and also because there's not a single Tea Party. There are Tea Parties. And one of the things that you notice when you look at the Tea Party is that it, too, is divided. Some of these people sound almost like Bernie Sanders when they talk about banks. These are not traditional country club Republicans, the great bulk of the Tea Party people. They are people that feel they were cheated in the Great Recession, and that they feel they are constantly cheated by the economic policies of the country. And then there's the Warren Sanders movement. I made that up. You could call it Move On, because Move On this week endorsed Bernie Sanders. They are basically a revival of the New Deal tradition and populism. Their ideas are basically to be found in Paul Krugman's Conscience of a Liberal, if you've read that book. But for a very long time, the Democratic Party had moved into a position of conceding that the Reagan Revolution had been successful, and had moved away from that revolution. Now there is this element in the Democratic Party, as there was in the Labor Party, to go back to the earlier tradition and say, we want to fight the economic elite. I could tell you all about Mr. Sanders' positions, but I won't. I don't have time. But you read about them daily, and you will hear about them on Thursday night, isn't it, this week, when there is yet another debate. So, American Anchor, a recap. There's a strong anti-elitist feeling in this country that, among other things, is upset by crony capitalism. And in many ways, there are tea parties on the left and the right. There's a strong amount of negativism, but even more so, a feeling of being marginalized. I don't count anymore. And you feel that on the part of the left when they look at all of the police violence in this part of our society. And there is police violence. And on the right, when they think about all sorts of conspiracy theories. You remember last year when there were people who believed that things were happening in Walmart basements all over the country, and that there were tunnels being created between various Walmart basements, and we laugh at that. It sounds funny, but so many bad things are happening, people's fertile imagination takes over. I want to go back now to say a few things about how political theory might be able to help. There was a Tea Party slide that I forgot to put up. I like that. I found it the other night, and I think that eagle is a beautiful eagle. I want to say a few words now about philosophical engagement, because I'm going to ask you, rather than just be upset with all of this anger, to become engaged with it as people who are interested in philosophy. And if you're interested in philosophy, you are going to be interested in history also. It will take a while for the nervous owl to understand the dynamics of this politics of anger. It will take her even longer to diagnose and prescribe. And you know, new theory is not produced automatically just because there's a need for a new theory. Locke's liberalism and Smith's capitalism were not instant responses to 16th and 18th century developments. There was a long wait between the Greeks and Augusta. The whole of the Roman Empire, the whole of imperial history, went without any new political theory. When politics was discussed, it was discussed only in terms of the Greek city-state. And so the Romans turned to a law, to jurisprudence, as we do, right? We Americans don't think of ourselves as philosophers, so we turn to the law to settle these issues that other societies thought of as philosophical issues. And then there's the problem of Marxism. Whatever you think about Karl Marx, he was brilliant. And his theories of worker alienation are basically taught in every organization theory course in the United States. And now many of the HR assumptions are based on that notion. But Marx failed. His theory failed, at least in application. And while his theories about alienation and so on are true, his economic theories were wrong. And his wonderful and simplistic belief that everything could be solved by getting rid of capitalism is one of those beliefs that can sometimes get you in trouble. But I want also to remind ourselves that while we need theory, grand theory, and while Marx's brilliance and his failure have really hampered people from trying to do that work, really hampered people from taking on that task, we have solved problems at a lower level than theory, than philosophy, For example, if you really feel very bad about the world and about how things are going, think about what happened at the end of World War I and World War II. World War I, that terrible Treaty of Versailles, all sorts of problems that eventually resulted in World War II. And then at the end of World War II, two world wars, you would have thought it would have been even worse. And what happened? People acted rationally. We Americans said, we're going to help you out, Europe, but before we help you out, you have to get together and tell us what you want. You get together and talk about this. Isn't that interesting? Instead of saying, we know what's good for you, we want to hear from you what you think is good for you. We want to have you work together. And out of that came that whole experience. They created the iron and steel community, or is it the iron and coal community, and eventually the European Union. Descriptive work will be needed. But I think also a willingness to live with some of these uncertainties as we get that work done. And we're going to have to be interested in epistemological issues. You know, oddly enough, we don't even have a common definition of politics. Because a common definition of politics involves so many normative assumptions. Some of you in this room think of government as basically a very minor part of our institutional life, or would like it to be a very minor part. Others of you see it as solving, as being a necessity to solve many problems, some of which we no longer think of it as necessary to solve. There was a long time in human history where we thought the government had to decide on the religion, right? The church by law established. Most societies no longer have a church by law established, do they? So I hope for new theory. I hope there will be, I don't want to say a new Karl Marx, should I say a new John Locke? I hope we find a way to make sense of our world again. Because I don't think we're going to solve many of these problems until we really understand the world we're living in. We have to do that before we can prescribe, so that we can move toward getting to that world that we can imagine. We have to know what's going on. And maybe that will help tell us also what we want to see in its place. That is a cop-out. Because, unfortunately, I've lived at the beginning of this current flight of the owl of Minerva, and I have no idea, though that doesn't stop some people from prophesying, but I am not inspired by God, and I don't know the future. I do know that we are rational people, and I do know that there is a large attentive public in the United States that if it gets involved and says some of these things and works in some of these measures, we may be better off than we are right now. Well, I'm ready to take questions.
Should turn on, just hold it.
It's still red.
Got a fairly new battery in it.
Well, y'all might have to talk loud. Okay, yes, sir.
I don't, I probably can get out without the mic. One of the complaints we hear lately is that our society is more polarized, not only at the voter level, but at the actual governmental level. One example is the problem with state legislatures. Seem to be, as they probably always have, but gerrymander voting districts.
It's gotten worse. Gerrymandering has gotten worse.
So that now it's hard to be elected unless you're at one extreme or the other. Do you think that that requires some sort of structural?
It could.
It could.
The Californians have worked on that by putting expert panels in. The Europeans are talking about that. It would help to work on those institutional issues. Actually, I suspect, and the president recently said this, I suspect there is more division at the elite level than there is among the great bulk of people. Because the polls show that there is a left and right in this country, but a huge central force. Now, the interesting thing is we have this illusion that the people who really think are those people who are not particularly partisan, and that's not true. It turns out that the people in the center are often the least informed. But the country is basically a center. This country has been historically a centrist country. I don't think that's changed. I could be wrong. If you got rid of some of the anger, you might get back to that. There's a question there.
First of all, I've got two questions. The first one is, how have you been political prognosticating in your career?
I do very little of it.
Okay, so have you, that doesn't exactly answer the question. How have you been successful? Do you pick the winners generally in your own personal life?
I haven't voted for the winners very often. most of the time, I've been pretty good at predicting who would win.
Okay, so then
which leads my students to think that I always agree with whoever I'm predicting, but I'm enough of a professional to try not to do that.
Okay, that's an awesome answer. Trump, Cruz, ideologues, demagogues, whatever. Your thoughts on those guys specifically and their success and their likelihood of being our next president?
Well, I think they both have a very good chance to be the next president. But you know, the problem is, it's so hard to get away from all your training. Every class I ever took on American politics would suggest to me that Mr. Cruz and Mr. Trump would not be the candidates of the Republican Party. But then I remember when I was very young, when it was dawn, just hammered into me that no Catholic could be president of the United States. And that remained true until John Kennedy was elected, right?
Or a black,
which remained true until Barack Obama was elected. And so it's gone, hasn't it? We are all creatures and captives of our training, aren't we? And so I frankly have trouble understanding exactly what is happening unless I fall back on this anger and on this desire that seems to be present in Europe and in the United States for people who are very committed to a certain principle, the principle of their auditors. And that may be explaining a lot. The trouble is, of course, I don't know what the trouble is. Mr. Cruz and Mr. Trump have attracted very large segments of their party, have they not? Yes, sir.
You talked about the anger. And at the beginning of your lecture, you said there's bad anger and the good anger.
No, I said anger can lead to good things and bad things.
Okay. I'm putting it on. So, do you see the anger in your life? Will lead to a good thing or to good results? Do you see that there might a revolution happen in Europe or like what happened in Egypt?
I think because of the institutional differences in Europe and in Egypt, the consequences would be different. But I could have said that. I can imagine you asking me this question in, say, 1928. And I'm saying, oh, no. The Nazis will never take over Germany, the most civilized country in Western Europe. Oh, people are flirting with this, but it's a momentary flirtation. Many political scientists wrote that at the time. And I don't really expect revolution. I expect that this will be maintained within the existing structure. But look at what's happened in Poland and Hungary. The people who've taken over those institutions have created almost a sham parliamentary system, the same system they had in the 1920s. And so it is possible. I think most of us, and we knew better, most of us, when the Soviet Union fell, when there was that period of rejoicing, and some rather foolish people saying it's the end of history because you have to have an enemy, and we'll never have an enemy again. And now most of us are saying, if we only have that kind of enemy, a rational nation state, where is the Soviet Union now that we need it? Because, you know, whatever else you could say about them, they were relatively rational, weren't they? They did not wish to destroy themselves. So it's very hard to predict This is probably a hiccup we're going through. If somehow I think maybe the Europeans made a mistake, but there are some economists in the room, and I'm not an economist, that probably they became too enamored of austerity, and they've subjected their people to too much austerity. And you know, the funny thing is, in 1948, we decided to let the Germans escape some of those austerity measures. We decided to write off all the debts of Hitlerite and Weimar Germany. And it probably helped the economy to improve more rapidly in Europe. And we wrote off the debts of our Western allies, didn't we? We didn't after World War I, but we did after World War II. And again, I don't know, certainly you cannot have what Greece has tried. She wants to have a smallholder society, you know, small businessman society, with a very robust welfare program. And those two things don't go very easily together. And I've escaped your question because I just don't know the answer.
Professor, you've really hit the mark that there is quite a bit of anger in the United States, political anger, that is, right and left, and it's divisive, etc. But looking at history, there's always been politics of the haves and have-nots, wanting those who don't have power in Greece and the Roman, the Optimates and the Plebeians, and etc. And you showed about the anger in Europe, but it seems like, you know, in history and in Europe, there's demonstrations and riots and blood in the streets, but not in America. Neither the far radical right or the far radical left has ever, you know, and we don't have blood in the streets. We don't have demonstrations. What's the difference?
Well, we had a little bit of blood in the streets in those anti-Catholic riots in the East in the 19th century. This is one of those great questions. We have not had that, and it's just like we never had a strong socialist movement in this country. And I can show you a whole library of books and try to figure out why that didn't happen. It has not been part of our history in large measure, they think, sociologists think, because so many Americans were taught to be self-sufficient. And when things like the Great Depression happened, they blamed themselves at some level. I'm not a good father. I'm not providing for my wife and my children. But you know, even so, in places like Kansas and Iowa and other places, when sheriffs came to foreclose on farms, very often the neighbors would show up with their rifles. They didn't aim the rifles at the sheriff or at the bank people, but the sheriff would say to the bankers, you know, if I were you, I just wouldn't bother having this foreclosure auction today. But you're right, I won't say we're not a violent people, we're a very violent people, but that violence has not been political, has it?
No.
And we've been very lucky, for example, in the great black movement, the black freedom movement, we had people who eschewed violence, in part because they were very, very pragmatic, but they were also, with Dr. King, inspired by Gandhi. And Dr. King was a Christian leader. So were so many of the black liberation leaders. So in some ways, I think our history and our society have mitigated against that kind of violence. We take out our violence in non-political ways, don't we?
Yeah.
The gangster, or that thing that happened in the 19th century, when all those young men leaving the war went west and created almost hell on earth in certain of the western towns. There's a question, but...
Would you not consider the militia occupation of the government building in Oregon a violent, politically motivated act, or the various riots that have happened in response to the police brutality and minorities seems to be a politically motivated violent act?
Yes, you're right to say that. The interesting thing about those acts
they are often seen by, if you read the descriptions of the people acting on them, they often did not use political terms, but they are obviously political acts. As for the Oregon occupation movement, that is a case where the desire of the people doing that occupy has been thwarted and frustrated by a government that learned the lesson of Ruby Ridge, hasn't it, and Waco. They just said, you know, we got ourselves in trouble before. And the sheriff in Waco had said, with the Black Ranch Davidians, that if the feds had come to help, he probably could have talked them into surrendering. And they didn't. And after that, the Clinton administration decided that they did not want violent confrontations. Now, some of the people in the on that other side, the people who have been very upset with police brutality, have said, probably rightly, that if those people in Oregon had not been white, there may have been federal response. But certainly the government has not wanted to do that response, has it? And the local people, while they're very upset at that occupation, have not wanted that response. And again, I'm not giving you a very complete answer because I think the government just did not want a riot there. They did not want what would be good worse than a riot. They would have been bloodshed. And there are so many people in this country right now who, after all, believe the government is plotting against their freedom. The government is afraid to do anything, almost afraid to do anything to enforce its authority. Or so some people think. It is amazing how many people really do think that there is that kind of control issue being considered. But you know, it's funny. Years ago, The Economist said about IRS, said, you know, when Americans talk about the IRS, they don't think about it the way we think about Inland Revenue, the British Inland Revenue. They think about their IRS as a combination of the Gestapo and the NKVD. You know, we have always, the Internal Revenuers, hated throughout American history. And many of us in this room probably had great-grandfathers who were distillers in their free time, right? And we hated that. You know, the federal government, the first revolution in this country against the new federal government was basically a mob rising against Internal Revenuers, right? The Shays Rebellion.
Question over here.
Yeah.
What do you think about the role of the media in what's happening in the United States, the anger, the fact that there are so many sources of information now, not one source?
So many sources of information, and some of them so geared to a particular audience. For example, though, you see when you look at the demographics on the Tea Party, that they fall pretty much like American demographics in general, in terms of education level, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. News source, completely different. Three-quarters, you know, almost four-fifths of the Tea Party members get their news from Fox. Whereas I suspect, this is a reality. This is simply a reality. The thing is, though, that it's not simply that. It's the way we structure the media. You know, I remember some of you in this room were as old as me, very few of you, but some of you, and you can remember when President Kennedy died, and what did we do? We did not get, day after day, 24 hours of news, did we? The news announcers, after that first shocking day, came on when there was some news to give. And we had the Boston Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, playing hour after hour. For those of you who are young, you need to know this happened. And we would see pictures of the White House, or we would see pictures of the Golden Gate Bridge, or the Statue of Liberty. Do you remember that, some of you? And that's probably a better way to do the news. And I think it managed to remind us that the country had survived. It was tragic to lose a young president, but the country had survived. And they did not contribute to a sense of panic.
oh my God, we've lost the President of the United States. Yes, but that's why there's a constitutional provision for a vice president to succeed, right? It's terrible to lose a president, but it's also nice to have a chain of command, a chain of succession. Some of the issues, too, that we are talking about tonight never get covered on television. They used to get covered on NPR, and people like Charlie Rose, bless his heart, tries to cover them from time to time on CBS in the morning. But we really have so many broadcasts that have two talking heads. One is labeled from the left and one is labeled from the right. And even if you talked about cheeseburgers, they would be expected to do a left and right stance on the cheeseburgers, right? Whereas a lot of life does not easily break itself down into left and right. It just doesn't. And we give them so little time, like those damnable debates we've been watching on both political parties. It's very good for sound bites. The media love those sound bites. Especially if you attack the other candidates, right? But you never really get a chance to spell out the kind of things we've been trying to puzzle out tonight. You don't get a chance for that kind of discussion, do you? And I suspect most of those candidates could do that. I just know that many of them are advised by their handlers not to. Oh, don't say what you're going to do. Oh, don't tell people this is a difficult question, because then they're going to think you're weak. You know, and they learn that. They learn that if they want to be president, they have to project this great confidence. But that great confidence really should be fairly frightening, shouldn't it? I mean, I'm worried enough that anybody would wish to be president of the United States. And you ever wondered about that?
Yes.
It's almost a masochistic desire. I want to be president and age rapidly and have my family attacked and be called a whatever, you know. It's hard to imagine anyone taking that on. Yes, yes.
Much of what people think about an election and what the news media talks about always involves the latest poll results.
Yes.
Now, everyone knows that for a poll to be valid, you have to have a random sample.
Right.
So I will not say that these people know enough about constructing polls to use a random sampling technique, but what I never hear mentioned is what do they do with those that respond to the poll that say, I have no opinion as of this time. If it's 1 or 2%, it doesn't make any difference, but if it's a significant number, they don't report it as these are undecided. They take it out and bias all the other numbers. Do you have any idea how much of that goes on?
Well, if you subscribe to polling services, you will get those figures.
Oh, you do?
Yes, you can. And I did in the last election cycle, because it really surprised me at how high they were before you divvied them out along a normal divvying out. Now, to be sure, pollsters are very good, but polls take a momentary picture of reality, don't they? And so we see Mr. Carson up, or then we see somebody else up, and we extrapolate so much from that when it might be just that nothing much happened, and Mr. Trump this time has benefited by the fact that so many people, that he's had so much airtime. Yes,
we're about out of time. Yeah. Just real quick, one last question.
Quick comment and question. Alternatively to the polar right-left, College Central has some terrific news.
Yes, they do.
Infotainment that shows both sides people. Question I have for you is, real quickly, because you're a young pollster, kind of a political guy, talk about social media from Arab Spring to what you think or where we're going in terms of fueling anger and all that kind of political thing.
The social media seems, and I haven't seen any tremendously good study, I'm sure there are, seems to be a great megaphone that distorts. But I noticed, for example, that we learned tonight that because the number of people watching the State of the Union speeches have gone down, that the White House had planned for a very, very major social media blitz on this from a variety of issues. Social media is something that Mr. Trump, for example, has understood very well, apparently, and so too Mr. Cruz. Mr. Cruz really has had more experts. Trump has been helped by people who are doing this on their own, in large measure. But he has some people that understand it and understand that the party isn't as important as it once was. You know, that's happened. In the last 50 years, the parties have ceased to be important. Conventions no longer really choose candidates, do they? And now we have people who are getting to be candidates, or it looks like that way, that are hated by their party. Mr. Cruz and Mr. Trump are not popular in party circles. It turns out that, and yet they may get the nomination. Now, how you govern, you know, that's Mr. Corbyn's problem. How you govern if your party, and I like Mr. Corbyn, but how you govern if your party isn't with you is problematic.
Let's give another round of applause.